For our audience of blind and print impaired readers, the North Carolina Reading Service presents The Indie Week. And this week's issue is dated February 24th of 2021. And it's read by John Federson, with you again after a two-week pause as our studio was closed last Thursday due to weather. But we kept our first-class musicians teams to play our music, and actually today we just picked them out of the Yellow Pages, and Mr. Anthony A. Aardvark, he came up first under the heading Radio Station Theme Song Services. Anthony A. Aardvark. And our first article, fairly relatively brief. Governor Cooper lifts North Carolina curfew after downturn in COVID cases. This will end on Friday, Governor said, announced yesterday as part of a series of restrictions being eased in response to a recent decrease in cases of the virus. He said during a Wednesday presser, "We have reason for hope in North Carolina. All the metrics we measure continue to stabilize. Starting Friday, the state's 10 p.m. modified stay-at-home order will be lifted, and alcohol sales will be allowed to continue until 11 p.m. Some businesses will be allowed to expand capacity, including certain indoor venues, bars, and movie theaters. The state's mandatory mask order, however, stays in place. Cases have been on the decline since reaching record highs in mid-January when the state was reporting more than 10,000 new cases each day with an 18% positive rate for testing. Now that positivity rate has dropped to about 6%. Secretary of Health and Human Services Mandy Cohen noted, "While we're improving since our peak in January, we still have more work to do. At the same time, we face a new challenge. Those new COVID variants are a wild card." As of Wednesday, the state has completed more than 10 million tests for the virus and has reported nearly 850,000 cases. There were 3,300 new cases reported on Wednesday, and 1,530 people remained hospitalized. Since the start of the pandemic, more than 11,000 people have died. Although restrictions may be loosening, Cooper urged citizens to remain cautious. "People are losing their loved ones each day," he said. "We must keep up our guard." Next, by Jane Porter, all North Carolina municipal elections scheduled this year could be postponed to 2022. For the first time in a long time, cities and towns like Raleigh, Cary, and Durham may not hold their municipal elections in an odd year. This afternoon, North Carolina State Board of Elections Director Karen Brinson Bell recommended moving all of North Carolina's municipal elections scheduled in 2021 to March the 8th of 22, and to move the primary elections scheduled for March of next year until May. Election officials hope this would allow lawmakers to address redistricting with complete census data, and that's scheduled to be released to the states on September 30. Reduce voter confusion and help eliminate municipal expenses. Under this plan, which Bell presented to the State House Elections Committee this afternoon, this was February 24, the North Carolina primaries would move to May the 3rd, the second primary to July the 12th, and midterm general election would be scheduled for November 8. According to Jerry Cohen, a Wake County Board of Election member, former NC General Assembly Special Counsel, and North Carolina elections expert for Raleigh, Cary, and Durham, this proposal, if adopted, would put municipal elections on May the 3rd of next year and any runoffs on July 12. According to state statutes, it would extend term lengths of elected officials in some municipalities from 4 to 7 months, depending on the 2022 primary date, Cohen said on Twitter. But municipalities that vote in odd years would return to their regular fall elections scheduled in 2023, shortening the terms of municipal officials potentially elected next year. though delaying these municipal elections isn't ideal and wouldn't be necessary without the former administration having meddled in the U.S. Census count last year, aligning the municipal and primary elections could improve voter turnout, especially in cities like Raleigh, where turnout in municipal elections in the fall of odd years is typically very low. Some 15% of the total electorate turned out to vote in the city's municipal election in 2019, compared with 80% of voters who turned out in the general election. And Bob Phillips, executive director of Common Cause, a nonpartisan group dedicated to creating good government through ensuring fair political districts, expanding voting rights and election integrity, and reducing money's influence in elections, said in a statement, "In light of this significant delay, the NC General Assembly should shift the state's 2022 primary election schedule to allow for sufficient time for a responsible redistricting process that is fully transparent and provides ample opportunity for robust input. The new congressional and legislative districts drawn this year are intended to be in place for the next decade and will have a dramatic impact on whether voters have a real voice in our elections. The people of North Carolina should not be shortchanged by a rushed redistricting process that undercut the right of voters to choose their representatives." While 45 municipalities in North Carolina scheduled to hold elections this year have the authority to change their own election dates, the Republican-led General Assembly will be responsible for approving any changes to the state's primary elections schedule. Now, Jane Porter has written another column, "North Carolina is a Testing Ground for How Republicans See Themselves Post-Trump." The last time I thought Republicans were in disarray, the seemingly long-shot candidate for president came from behind to beat the establishment Democrat in an election that shocked the entire nation and world. And, well, you know pretty well how the story goes after that. So I don't want to jump to the conclusion from reading this Washington Post story about North Carolina being a bellwether for Republican rejuvenescence, that the party is having an identity crisis or is struggling with how to move forward post-Trump. But that kind of does seem like what's happening here. Here are some takeaways. A lot of people are leaving the GOP, and so are donors. Whether they're leaving because they're disgusted with the events of January 6th or because they don't feel their leaders are standing up for Trump enough, they're leaving all the same. More than 20,000 Republicans have left the state party since November, according to data from Catawba College politics and history professor Michael Bitzer, and most have re-registered as unaffiliated. A former aide to U.S. Senator Richard Burr suggests these Republicans are largely from the suburbs, where elections are often won and lost, and the state party's vote to censure Burr likely won't help the matter. Then there are the donors. Local billionaire James Goodnight, founder and CEO of SAS, gave a lot of money to Republican congressional candidates last year, but a spokesperson says he won't be giving any more to candidates who, quote, "did not support the integrity of the election process that's vital to our democracy." Next, the race for Burr's Senate seat in 22 could be crowded. Mark Walker is definitely running. Mark Meadows is likely not running. Wilmington native and Trump daughter-in-law Lara Trump might be running, but despite proclamations from Senator Lindsey Graham, Trump advisors familiar with her thinking say they don't think she'll be running. Former NC Governor Pat McCrory is mulling running. So is U.S. Congressman Ted Budd, who voted to reject the electoral vote on January 6th. And here's something new. Michael Whatley, the relatively unknown chairman of the North Carolina Republican Party, who coordinated efforts across the state's party at the county level to censure Burr for his vote on Trump's impeachment, says he's also thinking about running. Depending on how things shake out, Republicans could face a nightmare scenario in the 22 midterms. Without Trump on the ballot, Republicans are unlikely to do turnout numbers that rival those in 2020, experts say. And if Biden does a good job managing the virus and the economic recovery, black and suburban voters may remain as motivated to go out and vote for Democrats again as they were last year to vote Trump out of office. John Anzalone, a Biden pollster who's done a lot of work in the South, says there is a universe of voters that is big enough to cause Republicans to lose that will only get out to vote for the cult leader. On the other hand, Paul Shoemaker, a longtime Republican strategist in North Carolina, says the midterm elections are, quote, about anger management and failed expectations for the party in control of the White House. If the Biden administration overreaches, he says, we can expect unaffiliated voters to break for Republicans. Next, Democrats are feeling bullish, at least at this point in the game. Jill Normington, advisor to Democratic Senate candidate Cal Cunningham, a guy who lost to Senator Tom Tillis in the Senate race last fall, is one who doesn't think the Republican vote will materialize again in 2022. I don't think any embracing of Trump from the Republican side means you can repeat that turnout, Normington says. One of the reasons it worked is that he was the epicenter of basically everything. The press was enamored of covering every fire he lit. And finally, the demographics in North Carolina aren't favorable for Republicans. Even with a surge in GOP turnout in 2020, Trump did worse in North Carolina by 2 points that year than he did in 2016. Morgan Jackson, a Democratic strategist for Governor Cooper, says that shows suburban voters are shifting towards Democrats, and most of the state's college-educated young voters are not breaking for Republicans. Jackson says he thinks heavy Republican turnout in 2020 was fueled largely by voters in rural counties without college degrees drawn in by Trump's crazy talk and loyal to him, not the GOP. Jackson ends the piece with this damning final thought, quote, Republicans are in a really bad spot. The only way you can replicate that turnout is to double down on the crazy talk, and that turns off swing voters. And meanwhile, they're kicking out people who don't pledge their fealty to Donald Trump. That's a lot of Republicans. Jane Porter has a busy keyboard this week. This column called The Federal Equality Act could make bills like HB2 relics of the past. Today, the U.S. House is set to pass the Equality Act, a sweeping bill that prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex, sexual orientation, and gender identity in employment, housing, education, jury service, federally funded programs, including health care, and businesses, and any other spaces or entities that serve the public. These include retail stores, exhibitions, recreation, amusement, and exercise providers, providers of goods, services, and programs, and transportation service providers. The Act covers public restrooms, locker rooms, and changing rooms as well. Identified as one of President Biden's top priorities in his first 100 days in office, the bill's passage would add protections for LGBTQ Americans to the nation's existing civil rights laws and would protect women and girls in public accommodations for the first time ever in federal law. This legislation was introduced multiple times in Congress in the past, but since it was last introduced in 2019, the U.S. Supreme Court found in a ruling last June that protections that the 1964 Civil Rights Act guarantee on the basis of sex extend to gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender Americans. Noah Ambrose, LGBTQ caucus chair for the Young Democrats of North Carolina, says, judicial opinions and executive orders from a president that protect LGBTQ equality can be easily undone. The Equality Act would codify non-discrimination protections people like me need for years, if not for my whole life. The bill also explicitly overrides the 1993 Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which mandates a higher standard for the government to have to defend laws that people argue infringe on religious freedoms. So, the RFRA couldn't be used to challenge provisions of the Equality Act nor could anyone use the RFRA as a defense for discriminatory conduct. This has religious conservatives, such as the folks at the North Carolina Values Coalition, up in arms and arguing the Equality Act would hurt women and people of faith, groups that the 1964 Civil Rights Act, quote, was created to protect. Tammy Fitzgerald wrote in an email message this week, she's the group's executive director, this bill would limit the free exercise of religion, attacking individuals, churches, charities, and businesses by forcing them to give up traditional norms regarding gender and marriage and recognize all forms of sexual orientation. The fundamental concept of male and female will be erased throughout the most basic parts of American life. Unquote. Ambrose says, serving LGBTQ people is not an infringement on any person's charities or business religious liberties. He says, as a gay man who's also a Christian, I firmly believe we are strongest in our country when we, the people, has been expanded to include everyone. Protecting people from discrimination is not an affront to God or religion. It never has been. There has always been pushback when certain groups have gained rights and stepped toward equality. But the only effect is more people being granted fundamental rights that every American should be guaranteed. North Carolina Congresswoman Alma Adams is one of the original sponsors of the Equality Act. Other North Carolina Democratic representatives to Congress, including freshman Congresswoman Deborah Ross and Kathy Manning, have said they will support the bill as well. Ambrose said this would be the most monumental victory for LGBTQ plus Americans in American legislative history. We're happy with how North Carolina's Democratic lawmakers, especially women, have been leading on this issue. The Equality Act faces a tougher fight in the U.S. Senate, where it will need the votes of all Democrats and an additional 10 Republicans to overcome the filibuster. Democrats could opt to bypass the filibuster, but it's not clear if all Democratic senators, including Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema and West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, will sign on. Now from Lee Toss, Wake County judge approves release of body camera footage of Fuquay Varina teen's detention. This judge will allow the release of body camera footage showing police handcuffing and detaining a black Fuquay Varina teenager after family members say he was falsely accused of stealing a dirt bike that he'd paid for. On January 30th, Malcolm Ziegler, 14, was in his front yard with a friend when two Fuquay Varina cop cars pulled up. Within seconds, he was handcuffed and placed in the back of a cruiser, despite pleas for officers to talk to his father, who was inside the home. The teen claims he had a bill of sale for the $900 dirt bike, which he had repaired himself and listed on Facebook Marketplace. The encounter was traumatizing, the family says. They've asked the department to release body camera footage of the incident. After petitioning the court, Wake County Judge Vince Rozier Wednesday approved the release of the footage with several redactions, including the faces of the other minors present and footage of an officer's cell phone that contained personal information. A dialogue containing information about the ongoing investigation into the stolen bike will also be redacted. It's unclear how quickly the footage will be released to the general public. Emancipate NC Executive Director Dawn Blegrove, who has been advocating for the release of the video on behalf of the family, was pleased with the judge's decision to make the footage public. Blegrove told the Indy, "We believe it's important for the people of Fuquay Varina to see Malcolm's face while he experiences the trauma of this interaction, hear the humiliation and fear in his voice. This situation could have been handled with so much more care. We hope FVPD and Town Council take seriously the demands for an oversight board and dive deep into policies that make interactions like this one okay." Now, this issue's cover story is titled Dreams Held Fast, and it's a timeline of black history in the Triangle. This is authored by Sarah Pequeno and Tomasi McDonald. And, well, you'll see, it's basically a several-page timeline with dates dating clear back to the 18th century. From the nation's first public university built by enslaved people to the demonstrators this summer who finally rid the Capitol grounds of its monuments to white supremacy, the history of the Triangle and its major towns and cities, Chapel Hill, Durham, and Raleigh, is inextricably intertwined with the history of its black residents. And black history is American history. And Black History Week, established as a precursor to Black History Month by the author and historian Carter Woodson, was an early affirmation and now an ongoing reminder that black lives matter. In honor of this February tradition, the Indy has created a timeline to recognize and celebrate the work and achievements of black activists, educators, and leaders in the realms of business, government, and faith. It's but a small sample of the contributions of so many over the centuries. And here we go. 1793. Enslaved black people begin constructing the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the nation's oldest public university. 1808. John Chavis, a free-born black man, opens a school in Raleigh. Chavis, who fought in the Revolutionary War, teaches white children by day and black pupils at night. January 31, 1865, the 13th Amendment abolishes slavery. 1865, again Shaw University, now the oldest black college in the Southeast, is founded. And James Henry Harris, born a slave, returns to Raleigh after time abroad in Africa and serves as a city alderman. He's also one of the founders of Oberlin Village. 1866, the White Rock Baptist Church, Durham's first black church, forms. In 67, St. Augustine's University is founded by the Episcopal Church to train black teachers. 1869, North Carolina ratifies the 15th Amendment, which gives black men the right to vote. November 3, 1875, James E. Shepherd, founder and first president of what will become North Carolina Central University, is born in Oberlin Village. 1868, the first African-American state legislators, 3 senators and 17 representatives, are elected to the General Assembly. 1870, Congress passes the 15th Amendment. 1880, John Merrick, pioneer business leader, arrives in Durham as a barber. He invests in real estate and builds his own home and rental properties. 1886, Wilson Caldwell, a university worker born into slavery, justice of the peace, and founder of a school for black children, is elected to the Chapel Hill Board of Commissioners. 1887, the Whitted School is built. James Whitted serves as superintendent of public grade schools for black children, including the Ledger School in Haiti and the Hack Road School. 1891, St. Joseph's AME Baptist Church is built. That's founded by Edion Markham. In addition to being churches, St. Joseph's and White Rock are bastions of activism and business catalysts where members create consensus about the importance of education. 1895, Dr. Aaron M. Moore helps organize a community pharmacy and drugstore, the Durham Drug Company, to train black druggists. 1895, folk musician Elizabeth Libba Cotton is born in what eventually will be Carrboro on Lloyd Street near the train tracks. In 1896, Sarah Hunter, wife of the head of St. Augustine's University, establishes the St. Agnes Hospital on the university's campus. The hospital serves as an accredited training school for nurses. It will be the only hospital and training school for African Americans between Atlanta and Washington, D.C., for nearly half a century. 1896, the Supreme Court upholds segregation in its separate but equal doctrine. 1904, pioneering comedian Dewey Pigmeat Markham is born. 1907, physician and businessman Manasseh Thomas Pope and partner M.A. Johnson found the Mechanics and Farmers Bank to provide banking services to the black community. 1910, Dr. James E. Shepherd, a businessman, opens the National Religious Training School in Chautauqua for the colored race. After changing names and ownership, the school is eventually recognized as NC Central University by the state legislature in 1969. It's the first state-supported university for black people in the nation. 1913, the second black library in North Carolina, the Durham Colored Library, is founded in the Baraka, a borrowed room in the White Rock Baptist Church. 1919, Dr. Manasseh T. Pope mounts a bid for a seat on the Raleigh City Council. 1921, black women open the Effland Home for Wayward Girls, serving black girls who tended to be incarcerated in adult jails, unlike white children and black boys. 1921, builder and businessman Calvin Leitner constructs the Leitner Arcade and Hotel on East Harget Street, downtown Raleigh's Black Main Street. It becomes a social hub for black Americans during Jim Crow. 1926, Louis E. Austin, fiery editor and publisher, establishes the Carolina Times, a black weekly newspaper with the slogan, "The Truth Unbridled." The Times becomes one of the most influential newspapers in the state. And parenthetically, I might say that this station reads from that Carolina Times, which is still being published on our weekly show. Next, 1933, black American attorneys Conrad Pearson and Cecil McCoy file an action on behalf of Thomas Hockett against the University of North Carolina, ushering in the desegregation of state-funded universities. 1935, the city's best-known blues man, Fulton Allen, also known as Blind Boy Fuller, records with the Reverend Gary Davis in New York, popularizing the Piedmont Blues. 1938, Pauli Murray is rejected from UNC's graduate program because she is black. She later becomes an Episcopal priest and delivers her first Eucharist, or communion, at Chapel of the Cross in Chapel Hill, the same church where her grandmother was baptized as an enslaved person. On October 13, 1938, Shirley Caesar, the First Lady of Gospel, is born. And 1940, P.R. Gervais, Sr. starts the Carolinian newspaper. April 22, 1947, Durham's John Hope Franklin publishes the landmark volume From Slavery to Freedom, A History of Negro Americans. He will become a leading American historian. 1953, Rinsher Harris becomes the first black man elected to the Durham City Council. In 1958, he's the first black man appointed to the city's school board. 1954, the Supreme Court releases its landmark ruling desegregating schools, Brown versus Board of Education. 1956, Joseph and Elwina Holt apply to enroll their son, Joe Jr., in the all-white Josephus Daniels Jr. High School in Raleigh, launching a three-and-a-half-year fight to integrate Raleigh City schools. 1957, seven black demonstrators are arrested for conducting a peaceful sit-in at the Royal Ice Cream Company in downtown Durham in one of the country's first civil rights sit-ins. And 3 years later, February of 1960, four black students staged that sit-in at a Woolworth's lunch counter in Greensboro. 1960, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. addresses the congregation of the White Rock Baptist Church, delivering his history-making "Fill Up the Jails" civil rights speech. 1960, nine Lincoln High School students stage a sit-in at Colonial Drugstore on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. The next day, around 100 young people picket outside in solidarity. 1960, Bill Campbell, the first black student to attend an all-white Raleigh City school. Again, 1960, Ella Baker, a Shaw University valedictorian and the first national director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, forms the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee on the Shaw University campus. SNCC's young leaders will incorporate Baker's philosophies of militant anti-racism, grassroots organizing and subverting class and gender hierarchies. 1961, the Duke University Board of Trustees votes to admit undergraduate students regardless of race. Again, 1961, businessman John Winters becomes the first African-American elected to Raleigh's city council. 1963, NC State and Shaw University students protest segregation at Raleigh's State Theater on Salisbury Street. 1963, black demonstrators are arrested at a peaceful sit-in at a Howard Johnson's restaurant in Durham. 1966, Duke University hires its first black faculty member, Samuel Dubois Cook. Black students take over the Allen Building on the East Campus to protest the school's racial climate. 1966, attorney Floyd McKissick is named National Director of the Congress of Racial Equality. 66, Hortense McClinton joins the UNC Chapel Hill School of Social Work, becoming the university's first black faculty member. 3 years later, Blyton Jackson will become UNC's first black professor. 1969, Duke students, many from the Afro-American Society, occupy the Allen Building to protest the university's treatment of black students. 1969, UNC Chapel Hill cafeteria workers go on strike with the support of the black student movement. And again in 1965, Howard Lee is elected mayor of Chapel Hill, the first black man to lead any predominantly white southern town. 1971, civil rights activist Ann Atwater serves as co-chair of a charrette, along with local KKK leader C.P. Ellis, that eventually leads to the desegregation of Durham's public schools. 1973, Josephine Dobbs Clement becomes the first black woman to serve on the Durham City Board of Education. And in 1973, Clarence Lightner is elected mayor of Raleigh, the first African-American elected mayor of a majority white major southern city in the United States. 74, Raleigh's John Winters and Fred Alexander of Mecklenburg County become the first black Americans elected to the North Carolina State Senate since Reconstruction. 1975, Muhammad Mosque No. 34 is renamed the Durham Muhammad Masjid, followed the death of national leader Elijah Muhammad. Now named Ar-Razak Islamic Center, it is Durham's oldest masjid. 1975, the Haiti Heritage Center, formerly the home of St. Joseph's AME Church, opens. And in 1975, architect Phil Freelon graduates from NC State's School of Design. 1978, John Baker, elected sheriff of Wake County, North Carolina's first African-American sheriff since Reconstruction. And in 1981, Michael Jordan plays his first game for the Tar Heels, scoring 12 points. 1989, Chester Jenkins is elected Durham's first black mayor. 8 of the 13 city council members are black. 1991, Dan Blue becomes the first African American to serve as Speaker of the House in the General Assembly. 1995, Dr. Sharon Elliott Bynum and her sister, Pat Amici, co-found Healing with Care, Incorporated, a nonprofit community-based organization to support people living with HIV/AIDS. 2008, the Marion Cheek Jackson Center opens in Northside, honoring Marion Lovett Cheek Jackson, the historian of St. Joseph CME since the 1950s. And in 2018, Silent Sam, toppled by protesters. 2019, then presidential candidate Kamala Harris delivers a keynote speech at the 84th anniversary banquet of the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People. The summer of 2020, following weeks of protest after George Floyd was killed by Minneapolis police, anti-racist activists and Black Lives Matter supporters in Raleigh topple two Confederate statues from a monument at the state capitol. And finally, 2021, North Carolina Central University graduate, MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, and civil rights titan, the Reverend William Barber, delivers the homily at the inaugural prayer for President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Harris. Next, by Tomasi MacDonald. In his quest to become anti-racist, Duke must reckon with a past that echoes into the present. Can Duke really become anti-racist? That question was emblazoned on the cover of the 2020 winter edition of the Duke University Alumni Magazine and probed with essays, feature stories, and text excerpts from podcasts, mostly responding to the larger racial reckoning that swept America following George Floyd's death. Letters to the editor in the issue offered mixed reviews about the magazine's coverage of the Black Lives Matter protest, but an incendiary letter submitted by Charles Philip Klutz, a 1961 Duke graduate, unleashed anger on social media. Klutz called the, quote, constant reminders of systemic racism wearisome, and said black men should marry, take care of their children, avoid drugs, stay out of jail, and realize that acting white by studying is not a bad thing. Duke Magazine editor Robert Blywise and Sterley Wilder, the associate vice president of alumni affairs, quickly issued an apology and tried to create distance between the magazine and the letter. Some alumni felt the apology was insufficient. Sabrina D. commented on the magazine's Facebook page, I am a young black alum and I am utterly disgusted that these letters that spread lies, racism, and violence were published. I don't accept this apology because it isn't an apology. And furthermore, there's nothing to make right what was wrong. This was very disappointing, but not surprising. Just months before Floyd's death prompted Duke President Vincent Price to weigh in on racial injustice. Writing in the magazine's summer edition, it was time for white people to consider the impact of systemic racism and, quote, engage deeply and with humility, humanity, and honesty. But the letter's publication suggests that for white people in power, engaging is much easier to talk about than to actually do. It's not surprising that systemic racism is alive and well at Duke, or that the university's history of racism was anything but a prelude to the school's ongoing struggle with race relations on campus. In an essay in the summer issue called A More Complicated Love, Duke University archivist Valerie Gillespie explains the tension between the school's past and present. She explains, while we became a university only in 1924, we began our life as an educational institution in 1838. Our records are scant about who worked at the school beyond the faculty, but we have information from the 1850s that Braxton Craven, president of the institution, owned enslaved people. He also sought to purchase two children, according to an affidavit in the state archives, but chose not to. The price was higher than he wanted to pay. Gillespie adds that Duke apparently had also rented enslaved labor at times, and writes, the university's treatment of black labor remains an issue today. Mark Anthony Neal, the James B. Duke Distinguished Professor of African and American Studies at the university, says Duke, quote, has long had the reputation of being a plantation in Durham as the city's largest employer. For many black residents, Duke isn't a world-renowned university, but simply the place they go to work, and where they might in fact feel undervalued and underpaid, Neal wrote in an email to the Indy. Duke's relationship with race is encapsulated by the efforts of Julian Abele, the black architect who designed more than 30 buildings on the campus, including the Allen Building and the iconic Duke Chapel. But Abele was never allowed to set foot inside the storied sanctuary after it was completed in 1935. Of course, the Allen Building was the site of a black student occupation in 1969 at the height of the Black Power movement. In 2016, Duke honored Abele's lasting contributions by naming the campus' busiest quadrangle the Abele Quad. Also, in 2016, 9 Duke students took to the Allen Building to demand better treatment for the university's black workers, prompting administrators to pay all university employees the City of Durham's official living wage of $12.35 an hour. A year later, Duke raised its minimum wage to $13 and then to $15 per hour in 2019. Collective action is not new at Duke, but these forward strides have not always translated as effectively in other facets of life on the campus. Thomas Siegel, a 1977 Duke graduate and author of Point of Reckoning, The Fight for Racial Justice at Duke University, published last month by the University Press, chronicles a cache of present-day racist incidents on campus that he calls a troubling echo of the 1960s. These include, in 2015, a noose found hanging near the student center, and a 2017 report from National Public Radio where African American students at Duke's Divinity School described feeling like they had entered a racial nightmare, seemingly from another era. Black students were not the only people of color targeted. In 2019, Megan Neely, then Director of Graduate Studies in the Department of Biostatistics, sent an email asking international graduate students to refrain from speaking Chinese inside the department or in other professional settings because, she said, she had overheard two other professors complaining about students speaking loudly in Chinese. Siegel chronicles the reaction of the pioneering Duke pediatrician and professor Brenda Armstrong, who, as a leader of the school's Afro-American Society, organized the black student takeover of the Allen Building in 1969 to protest the racial climate on campus. Before she died in 2018, Armstrong served as Associate Dean for Admissions at the Duke School of Medicine for more than 20 years. In addition to working as a Senior Associate Dean for Student Diversity, Recruitment, and Retention. And she said of the racist incidents that polluted the campus before her death, "Everybody has a gift, and nobody's gift is better than anyone else's. But that culture of sharing and appreciating each other's gifts has not been achieved." Siegel, an attorney and a board member at Duke's Center for Documentary Studies, writes that the school's janitors, maids, and other service workers were historically underpaid. He writes, "The old way of running Duke was you hired 10 blacks to do the job of 2, and you paid them a tenth of what they should be paid. Under this system, Duke's maids were paid 43 cents per hour in 1951. By the start of 1959, the hourly amount was 65 cents per hour, earning maids a paycheck of $19.50 for a standard 30-hour work week. By 1965, Siegel writes, when maids' wages were increased to an average of 85 cents per hour, it was still far below the federal minimum wage of $1.25, with no holiday or sick leave. And he says maids had to go from house to house and clean up for white folks to survive, or else they went on welfare. Duke's historical mistreatment of his black employees resonates with Brett Chambers, a 1979 Duke graduate whose grandmother worked as a maid at the university during the 1940s and 50s. Chambers told the Indy he still feels bitter that his grandmother's work went unappreciated. A native of Maryland, Chambers spent summers growing up in the shadow of the university's East Campus in Durham's Walltown neighborhood. In addition to his grandmother cleaning woman's dormitory room, his cousin worked as a gardener on the campus. But when his mother, a black woman, wanted to apply for admission, she couldn't because of the racial bar. "My mom couldn't go to Duke, but goddammit, I said I'm going to go," he says. "Black people were working in the hospitals and cooks and nurses doing all the work, but my grandmother's child was not even allowed the privilege to be rejected by Duke." Does Chambers think moving forward the Duke can become anti-racist? "No," he says adamantly. He teaches journalism at North Carolina Central University and says Duke is fundamentally racist. But he says the university acknowledging its racism is a huge step. Siegel notes that when Duke's Board of Trustees finally voted to end the school's racially exclusive admissions in 1961, the primary reason wasn't an altruistic ideological change. It was money. Increasingly, he writes, the federal government and national foundations were making clear to Duke and other southern universities that grants would stop if they refused to admit black students. Neal describes the role of race in the classrooms of predominantly white institutions as complex. Quote, from the standpoint of being a black professor, whiteness becomes a default for expertise. So for students, even those who are black, there's often an unconscious bias that professors of color are less prepared, less capable, and that their educational experience is diminished because of it, especially when it comes to discipline in which faculty of color are perceived as unicorns. Duke's racial inequity problem has not been relegated to isolated incidents. In 2019, the university vetoed a proposed $3.3 billion Durham Orange Light Rail Transit project after university officials outlined four unresolved challenges related to the rail's alignment and construction, including disruption from building, noise, and liability. Several local leaders concluded, according to reporting from the Indy, that Duke's upper echelon never wanted the light rail in the first place. Mayor Steve Shule told the Indy last week that the light rail project was part of the city's shared equity strategy because it would have helped a lot of low-income residents get access to good jobs. And the last section, making amends. Michael Ivory Jr., an African-American student from Miami, was admitted to Duke in 2014. In an essay published in the Alumni Magazine's winter issue, Roots of the Matter, Ivory considers the university's anti-racist efforts and recalls a freshman year to Shooters 2, a club near East Campus and a popular student hangout. While waiting to get inside, Ivory writes, he struck up a conversation with a black man, a Durham resident. And he wrote of the conversation, out of these facts came one of the most disturbing lessons I would ever learn. The young man told him that in many black communities, Duke is called a modern-day penitentiary. He remembers the man saying, we say that when you're born, Duke signs your birth certificate. When you work, Duke probably signs your paycheck. And when you die, Duke signs your death certificate. In the months after that visit to Shooters, Ivory says he entered into the gauntlet of academic and personal growth that defines the transition to college. Then a noose was hung on campus. Ivory concludes that Duke, quote, has a number of ways to enact its anti-racist vision, but here is what I know. Race and racism has always been a matter of roots. I can't remain satisfied with the pruning of branches, he writes. He's now enrolled in graduate school at NC State University and told the Indy last week that the university has made decisions and signed contracts that, quote, literally displace whole neighborhoods. And he says, Duke, by all means, should look at what it looks like to relinquish land. And notes that Duke should listen to organizations that, quote, Durham decides to offer as its voice on solutions for a range of issues. Neal says there has been some degree of change with more black people in position of leadership on campus and that it is clear that Duke is a different place. In 2020, 9% of undergraduate students were black and 40% white, per university data. For faculty, the range is about 15 to 70%. And let's see. Neal says, yet to articulate the values of anti-racism, virtue signaling, as it were, is the easy part. This is going to be hard work, and 400-plus years of anti-black racism in the United States will not be resolved because a few college administrators finally saw the light because of George Floyd. And he adds, it is disingenuous and disrespectful to those folks who have been waging battles against anti-black racism around the world, in this country, and even at Duke, to think this can be addressed by a few pronouncements. Now, sometimes we let the cultural aspects from the Indie Week suffer a little bit towards the end of the broadcast. Well, I have the time to read this memo from Dan Ruccia about a new local opera, which illuminates the texture of small-town life and its family secrets, Kith and Kin. And it comes out on November the 1st from Albany Records. A few weeks ago, soprano Andrea Edith Moore was walking her dog down an alley in her Durham neighborhood when she came across a bomb squad removing a forgotten World War II mortar. A neighbor had discovered it in a crawl space left there by a previous owner of the house. Mesmerized, Moore hurried home. "I was like, I'm the nosy neighbor, and I posted to the listserv," Moore recalls, laughing. "I felt like I had come upon this discovery. It was a tangible moment of, oh my gosh, I've got to share this." That same energy of secrets, of being in your neighbor's business, of the deep connectedness that underlies a community, animates her new recording on Daniel Thomas Davis's chamber opera, Family Secrets, Kith and Kin, released in November on Albany Records. Written in and commissioned by Moore in 2015, the work unfolds in a series of seven vignettes from life in an imagined southern town, each built around some kind of secret, real or imaginary, hidden or revealed, dark or light. The work uses texts from seven authors, each of whom has a connection to Orange County: Alan Gerganis, Lee Smith, Francis Mays, Michael Malone, Daniel Wallace, Jeffrey Beam, and the late Randall Keenan, who passed away in late August. Moore and Davis grew up in North Carolina themselves, making this a celebration of the area's art scene. Moore initially conceived of the piece in 2008 after returning home from a two-year stint working as a singer in Hamburg, Germany. She settled in Hillsboro with her parents, who gradually introduced her to the town's vibrant literary life, including many of these authors. By around 2011, she decided she wanted to commission a new work that brought them together, something that reflected the worlds of these contemporary Southern writers. She settled on the theme of family secrets because everyone has them, and I know that a Southern writer without family secrets just wasn't doing the right thing, you know? She was right. The writers turned in piles of texts. She jokes Jeffrey Beam submitted 100 poems. In reality, it was closer to 30. And she and Davis began sifting through the texts, condensing them down and giving them shape. They began to discover connections between them. "These writers all know each other," Davis writes in the liner notes, "and one way or another, the people that inhabit their writing all seem to know each other too." That insight is a driving principle in Family Secrets, allowing these seven distinct literary voices to meld into a single village. It's a town brimming with recognizable figures and the complex emotional relationships that grow in a place where, for better or worse, everyone knows everybody else. Take The Porch, which adapts a poem by Beam. In the distance, some neighbors are singing an imagined folk song accompanied by a crackly banjo, while Moore's character zeroes in on details of the neighborhood swirling around her. She spins a web of evocative metaphors, buttressed by vast open harmonies from a five-piece ensemble, banjo, violin, cello, piano, and oboe. Within those observations comes a sudden burst of sadness for someone who is gone. "Will you return?" she asks, "or will your absence become coolness?" Later, the scene peaks when that absence becomes a sweet and deafening silence over an impossibly ebullient musical texture that seems to contain more sound than five instruments could possibly make. Heard now, the layers of emotion are almost too much to bear. Even more complex is Keenan's Chinaberry Tree, which recounts the true story of his aunt's murder at the hands of his uncle. What starts as a hopeful tale of a return to the South for retirement takes a grisly turn that reflects the many roles we inhabit in our lives, all silently observed by an omnipresent, disinterested Chinaberry Tree. Davis twines Moore's singing with spoken narration by actor Jane Holding, with one echoing or foreshadowing the other throughout. Unlike the rest of the opera, which seems to be congenitally rooted in folk music, this scene is driven by the logic and turbulence of post-minimal classical music. Keenan was notorious for missing deadlines, and Davis had already started writing music when he finally, bashfully, submitted his text. But the story he wrote, as Moore recalls, anchored the whole thing and turned it into an operatic scale. Davis calls it a parable of the Great Migration and race and violence and the American South, these painful histories that are cyclical. Not everything in the opera is heavy. Gurgenis and Smith's contributions crackle and fizz with the primal joy of gossip. But yes, even knowing Sheila, I am the least bit surprised, Moore declares at one point. Wallace's The Pantry, meanwhile, charts a fantastical voyage of discovery in a hidden corner of the pantry over a slurred honky-tonk piano. It's these moments of levity that give the darker moments their impact, enhanced throughout by Davis's warm, evocative music. While Moore has performed Family Secrets a few times already, including at the North Carolina Opera in 2018, any planned performances around the record have, of course, been scrapped. We're all feeling the coolness of absence right now. Being able to go see this on the stage would be a great way to replace that coolness with warmth, to see and be seen, to gossip about it, and maybe, as Alan Kirkanis says in the epilogue, be saved from our worst selves. Well, we've had to forego three more articles in the Indie Week. Now, this issue is a podcast, and you can access it again if you wish by finding the podcast section of our website. And that website, ncreadingservice.org, and it's titled Independent. So as Anthony A. Aardvark and his large ensemble serenade us, John Federson hopes you will find us again for our reading of the next issue of Indie Week. So long for now, everybody.